Okay.
So in the previous couple of talks, I talked a lot about the... There's no chalk.
Right.
Oh, right there. So I talked a lot about the various aspects of the mathematical structure or the mathematics of these Calabi-Yau singularities. And today I wanted to talk a little bit about the quote-unquote physics of these things. So, I mean, the reason that we're interested in this class of singularities is because of possible applications to string compactification. And there are some places where we have a really thorough and successful understanding of how the correlation works. Maybe we should shut that door. And there are other places where we don't. So the basic picture is, so we have these five string theories in 10 dimensions. And we also have 11-dimensional supergravity, some quantum version of that called M-theory. And there's also a construction known as F-theory, which I'll mention shortly. And in all of these cases, what one does is looks at a space-time which has a form of some effective Minkowski space, and then some compact part. So this is the entire space-time, where typically this y is a compact Riemannian manifold. And then the place where people have made the most progress is in assuming that the effective theory on the Minkowski space is supersymmetric, and that implies that these y's are very highly restricted. So I don't want to give a complete survey of string compactification here, but typically y is some kind of Calabi-Yau manifold if we're taking Minkowski space as the other factor, and for some of the string theories there's some additional data which has to be specified as well. Well, actually, for all of them, there's some additional data in terms of some differential forms which form part of the parameters of string compactification in addition to the natural geometric parameters that the Calabi-Yau manifold itself had. So, as I was just kind of alluding, the geometric parameters, or there are geometric parameters which include typically a metric and some harmonic forms, and maybe sections of some bundle, some gauge bundle, in some of the cases. These geometric parameters typically, at least at the classical level of understanding the string compactification, or at this, I should call it the semi-classical level of understanding the string compactification, they can be freely specified. And on the other hand, there are limits of these parameters, which include singular Calabi-Yau spaces. So the ability to formulate a reasonable version of string compactification really depends on the manifold being non-singular. It depends on, in fact, being able to increase the distance scales so that this manifold is very close to being flat, and you know, as you increase the distance scale even more, gets to be a better and better approximation to a flat manifold, and that's important for some aspects of formulating string theory with a target on those manifolds. And that stops being the case if you've allowed singular Calabi-Yau spaces to be part of the limits. So it's a natural question, what happens to the physics at such singularities? And that's what I'm going to try to address in some of the cases today. So the first phenomenon I want to talk about actually has nothing to do with singularities. It has to do with some aspects of the heterotic string or the type 1 string compactified on a torus. So in the heterotic or type 1 string, we take a torus of dimension n, so that's some Rn mod Zn. We want to specify a metric on this torus, and we probably have to specify a two-form called the B field as another part of the geometric parameters. And in addition to that, we need a gauge bundle. So the heterotic or type 1 strings have a sort of natural 10-dimensional gauge group and that 10-dimensional gauge group is either, in the heterotic case, it can be E8 cross E8 semi-direct Z2, or spin 32 mod Z2. So the Lie algebra is pretty familiar in both of these cases. The Lie group being specified, you have to be careful about the global structure. So these are in the heterotic cases, and I should say that it really is SO32 in the type 1 case. So it turns out that the center of spin 32 is Z2 cross Z2, and if you take the quotient by one of the Z2s, you get SO32. If you take the quotient by either of the other Z2s, you get groups which are isomorphic to each other. So that notation, spin 32 mod Z2, designates the non-SO32 quotient by Z2. And this semi-direct Z2 here refers to switching the two factors of the E8, which is also a global symmetry of the theory. Okay, so we have these possibilities for global groups. And the way you specify the gauge bundle in this simple case of a toric, so I should take a flat metric on Tn, excuse me. In the simple case of a toric, of a torus, is you can take generators, gamma 1 up to gamma n, which are generators of h lower 1 of y, and each of these generators is represented in a standard way by a loop, and each gamma I should go to some basically holonomy of in the gauge bundle. So you can think of that as an element of the gauge group. And then the effective gauge group well, saying what the effective gauge group is slightly complicated, but the effective gauge group has as its tangent space let's see, for generic metric, the tangent space of the effective gauge group is, so I actually, for strange reasons, have to put in a factor that has nothing to do with the original gauge group, but which has to do with the so-called Kaluza-Klein reduction process. So these are gauge fields which end up coming from the fact that I reduced from 10 dimensions down through n dimensions to some effective theory, but it's plus the set of elements of the algebra. Well, the easy way to say it is the tangent space of the simultaneous commutator of gamma 1 of this is GI, G1 through GN. The reason I have to say for generic metric there is that there can be a little bit of non-abelian gauge algebra showing up for special values of the metric parameters that involves this U1 factor as well. But I don't want to try to describe that issue. There is a very well-defined procedure for working out at least what the gauge algebra is in this case.
So by commutative of G1 to GN, you mean the group element that commutes is
gauge? That's right. Commutant, thank you.
And when you say gauge bound, do you have to assume that there is a flat connection to
value? Sorry. So the
is it true that in general there may be no flat connection?
I'm assuming there's no H field. I'm assuming that H is zero.
Okay. And in that case, there's always a flat function?
I think so. Yeah, I need to think about that a little bit. I might be saying that wrong. So for most n-tuples, so the most typical thing which happens here is that you end up just getting a U1 to the 16 here, the rank of the group. But for special values of the G's, you can actually have some non-abelian gauge group left over in the commutant of these elements. So typically when you take a bunch of these are supposed to be commuting elements because they had to generate a representation of the fundamental group there. And when you take the commutant of a bunch of commuting elements, then typically it's gotten rid of all of the non-abelian part of the group. Now there's another complication to the story, which has to do with the fact that the set of possible commuting elements actually has multiple components, and so this typically is at the generic point of the identity component. But if you take the generic of the identity component of commuting n tuples, right? So by identity component, I mean the component containing the identity counted n times, which is a commuting n tuple. But the set of commuting n tuples in a Lie group can be disconnected, and you might get even a smaller abelian algebra as the tangent space of the commutant in the generic case. Sorry, I didn't really want to get into that. I just wanted to make an accurate statement here. So the moduli roughly looks like the choice of element in this Cartan subalgebra, a little bit enhanced there. Although at special points, you can think of what's happened as the gauge group has acquired some non-abelian part. Okay, so the only reason I mentioned that was because that phenomena was a guide to the first case where people understood in detail what was happening with singularities, and that's the case of the ADE singularities.
Can I just ask a
very
quick question?
Yeah, sure.
So the weight you have, two NU1s?
Momentum and winding modes.
Oh, okay.
So the gauge group in the effective theory has two sources. One is the kind of gauge group in 10 dimensions, and the other is things to do with the reduction process, and these are the other parts. So what was the story with ADE singularities on K3? Well, the story comes in a few parts. One of the parts says that if I do the heterotic string on a two torus, that's actually supposed to be dual in some, on a four torus, that's supposed to be dual in some appropriate sense to one of the type 2 string theories, the type 2a string theory, on the K3 manifold. So that's one of the dualities which was identified early on in the second superstring revolution. The possibility of such a duality had been anticipated many years earlier by Seiberg, who noticed the identity of the spectrum between these two things. And in fact, in both cases, it's easy to identify the moduli space in some natural way as having an R plus component and then being based on the group 04, 20, mod 04, 020, on that symmetric space. And then, of course, you have to mod out by some discrete group gamma. This is the moduli space in both cases, in some natural sense. So let's see, the U1 to the 8 part that I mentioned over there is sort of corresponding to a signature 4, 4 piece of this guy, and then the rank 16 part that I mentioned over there is sort of the remaining rank 16 that comes from the 10-dimensional gauge group. That's roughly how the parameters go. But there was a mystery, and the mystery was that over here, because there was this detailed study of the moduli space in the heterotic case, over here you expected non-abelian gauge symmetry at certain moduli values, certain parameter values, from the heterotic analysis. And the question was, where did that come from on this side? So the explanation, which was presented in some form by Witten and made more precise by Schwartz and Aspinwall, all in 95, goes like this. In the K3 moduli space, there are sort of paths towards the boundary of moduli in which certain CP1s shrink down to zero area. Now, from the point of view of this description of the moduli space, I slightly lied or simplified in the K3 case, because the moduli space in the K3 case really omitted, if you were literally talking about moduli for non-singular K3s, then you had to omit some set that I like to call script Z which corresponds to K3s with ADE singularities. Well, just because that was supposed to be the moduli of non-singular ones, and initially we only knew how to do sigma models in the case where the thing was non-singular. And this phenomenon of the CP1s going to zero area, or collections of CP1s going to zero area, is exactly, so the CP1s go to zero area, exactly corresponds to the approach to this set Z. Something further was realized once D-brains were in the picture, which is that one can wrap a D2 brain around the CP1, giving a massive particle in the effective theory. And the mass of the particle is proportional to the area of the CP1. So if this duality is to be believed, then following these paths into Z, where what you see as kind of the evidence of something funny going on being that the CP1 is going to zero area, amounts to making those particular particles massless. And the effect of those new massless particles, so at Z we get new massless particles, and the calculation, which Witten, Aspinwall, and Schwartz were making, was that the spectrum of these massless particles, the spectrum of these new particles, exactly corresponds to the off-diagonal terms in the gauge fields at non-abelian points. I guess I should have also said that Z on the heterotic side exactly equals the set of points, set of parameters, where the effective gauge group is non-abelian. Pardon? No, this is an analysis basically based on periods in both cases. So here you analyze the moduli of K3 using periods, and you identify the singularities in terms of their effect on periods. And over here, the identification of that same set Z as the place where the gauge symmetry gets enhanced comes by people calculating carefully with where the commutant would have some non-abelian part. Yes?
Can you also get Riemann surfaces collapsing?
Not on a K3. With the issue is that how do I want to say it? The only Riemann surface that has negative self-intersection number on a K3 is a CP1. And if you attempted to take something, a positive self-intersection number, and collapse it, you would not be able to collapse it without collapsing sort of everything. So the K3 itself could go to zero volume, but that's the only way that you can get Riemann surfaces of higher genus going to zero. There is a sort of intermediate case, which is an elliptically fibered K3, in which the elliptic fibers all go to zero size. That leads to F theory, and unless you leave, you're going to be subjected to some F theory today, in spite of your best efforts to avoid it. So the kind of conclusion is that the ADE singularities correspond to gauge symmetry enhancement beyond the abelian gauge symmetry that you already see. Here, by the way, well, let me not say that. At the generic point of moduli from the K3 side, you can also calculate an abelian gauge group. There is no obvious source of non-abelian gauge symmetry in the type 2 string, unlike the heterotic and type 1 strings where we had a 10-dimensional non-abelian gauge group. The only source of gauge symmetry really comes from the Kaluza-Klein mechanism, together with a possible gauge field in the 2B theory. And so you didn't really expect non-abelian gauge symmetry, yet according to the duality you were supposed to have it. This is what gives the explanation. So that was kind of the first case which was understood. I want to mention two related cases. So if I do the heterotic theory on a 3-torus, it came to be understood a little bit later that the heterotic theory on a 3-torus would be dual to M theory, the quantum 11-dimensional supergravity theory, compactified on the same K3. And in this case, the moduli space is based on O319, mod O3 cross O19, with an R plus as well. R plus is the volume on this side, and it's the heterotic coupling on that side. The same phenomenon occurs. There's a locus Z, I'll just call it Z again, where you're getting on the heterotic side gauge group which is non-abelian. On the K3 side, again, this corresponds to ADE singularities. And there is something called an M2 brain, which is available in M theory, which wraps the shrinking CP1, and in exactly the same mechanism provides the off-diagonal terms in gauge fields. So that one was in 6 dimensions. This is in 7 dimensions. And there's one more version of this story. Well, two more, but I'll stop with this one. So the heterotic theory on T2 corresponds to what's known as F theory on K3. And let me put that in quotes. So I mentioned that a minute ago that if you had a K3 surface which was elliptically fibered, that there was a limit in which the fibers in the elliptic fibration went to zero size. And that's this limit that leads to what's known as F theory. F theory is really a different kind of string theory called the 2B string theory. And it's the 2B string theory on the base of an elliptic fibration. And it uses the geometric data of an elliptic fibration. So what geometric data is there? Well, how the elliptic fibers depended on those parameters. So the J invariant and so on as a function on the base. It uses the geometric data to build a 2B string theory with typically varying coupling constant, which is an unconventional thing for string compactification, and what are known as D7 brains, located at the singular fibers. So there's a really pretty mathematical theory. Worked out first by Kadaira, which describes the possible local singularities in one parameter elliptic fibrations. So these are fibrations in the sense of algebraic geometry with singular fibers allowed. To make it a fibration in the sense of topology, you would need to leave out the singular fibers. And Kadari's classification went in terms of the monodromy on H1 of the elliptic curve, and told you a particular type. So he had some names. I'll just give you the names. Actually, let me put the type over here. And then you can also work out, and he did, what the geometry is for the corresponding singularity. So type I sub 0 was the type of no monodromy, and this was just a non-singular elliptic curve. Type I sub n is the case of monodromy 1n 0 1, and the geometry in this case is, let me refer to non-singular geometry and Weierstrass geometry. So in the Weierstrass model of an elliptic vibration, you contract the points, all components of fibers which don't meet the section. So this is the case of one parameter elliptic vibrations with a section. That's what you need for the F-theory construction. And if there's a section, there's a Weierstrass model for the whole family, which contracts all components of fibers not meeting the section to singular points. So what we get in the non-singular geometry for I sub n is some nice polygon of rational curves, one of which meets the section. And what we get in the Weierstrass model is all the rest of the curves being contracted, and they contract to one of the rational double point singularities, namely the singularity called a n minus 1. There are types 2, 3, and 4, and I forgot to look up the monodromies, but the monodromies have order 3, order 4, and order 6. Not sure if I want to draw you all the pictures. You've got a cuspal guy, which doesn't have any singularity. You've got a tangent guy, which ends up having an A1. And you've got a three-component guy, which ends up having an A2. Doesn't matter so much. You've got IN star, which has monodromy minus 1 n n. Minus 1, n, 0, minus 1. A slightly complicated picture here, which I'll just call dn tilde. And here you end up with a dn singularity, except this is k, where k and n are linearly related. And then you've got 2 star, 3 star, and 4 star. Sorry, this is order 6. This is order 3. And again, order 6, 4, and 3, and then 2 star is E8 tilde, this is E7 tilde, this is E6 tilde, and you get the singularities E8, E7, and E6. Details are less relevant than the fact that there are these explicit local models for elliptic vibrations. If you make the Weierstrass models, they include the local models for elliptic vibrations, include the entire ADE list of singularities. And there are a couple of sort of funny cases where the A1 and the A2 appear twice in the list, so it's not quite a one-to-one correspondence. But this is probably n plus 4. That's right. Anyway, there's this nice table. So the duality in this case asserts that the... Well, let's see. So one statement is that if you take an F-theory model on whatever the base is, and you compactify that further on an S1, that's dual to the M theory on the total space of the elliptic vibration. So because of that, we expect elliptically fibered K3s to give us exactly heterotic on T2, because that's the class of models which, when you compactify an S1, would give you heterotic on T3, and that's what the M theory is supposed to be. And the limit is actually given by, as I mentioned, the case where you are shrinking that elliptic fiber to zero size. If you shrink the elliptic fiber to zero size while expanding the base so that the volume stays constant, then you end up with this F-theory limit, in which you kind of lose the geometry, but you keep the remnant of it, which tells you how the data of the elliptic fiber was changing, and you use that data, you match that data with the SL2Z invariants of the type 2B theory to give an unconventional type 2B compactification. I should say that that when F-theory was new, there was also this proposed 12-dimensional interpretation of F-theory. That's one that I don't personally advocate anymore. So I have this F-theory, and again, the gauge symmetry enhancement behaves exactly as you would expect, that the singularity in the Weierstrass model determines the non-abelian gauge group.
Right. I didn't understand the terminology. So you have non-singular geometry and Weierstrass geometry. The Weierstrass geometry, is it fiber of the non-singular geometry?
Okay, so if I have a family of elliptic vibration, a one-parameter family of elliptic vibrations with a non-singular total space, then could I reclassify the fibers to be in this kind of picture?
So these are the fibers.
These are what the fibers look like, right? Now, in that total space, I can also form the so-called Weierstrass model, and the prescription for forming the Weierstrass model is to take all of the components of fibers which do not meet the section and blow them down to possibly singular points. So, and that's the one that has a natural equation. So the Weierstrass model always has this equation, like y squared equals x cubed plus g4 of the parameter x plus g6 of the parameter. And that has these kinds of singularities. So what one is expecting is that at if the F-theory moduli is such that you have one of these non-generic singular fibers, then you will get singularities in the M-theory dual, because the M-theory dual will actually be this Weierstrass model, not the non-singular model. So to get from Weierstrass to non-singular, you have to tune some Kähler parameters. Anyway, they're not available at the moment. They only become available after you go to M-theory.
Given non-singular
elliptically
fibered K3, there is an algorithm to construct
the Weierstrass model. That's right. Non-singular elliptically fibered with section. You have to have chosen the section.
With section. And this algorithm involves tuning of the Kähler parameter.
You can think of it that way. I mean, the F-theory limit was supposed to be tuning a Kähler parameter to try to essentially blow down the elliptic vibration, to shrink those to zero size, right? And since the components of the fibers are also going to be required to go down to zero size, the easiest way to do that is to first insist that all those other components go to zero size and then the general fiber go to zero size. It's conceivable that you could take some limit in which the components are going down at the same moment as the general fiber is, but it somehow seems easier to do it this way, and that naturally corresponds to the M-theory moduli. Okay, so we have these ADE singularities. They show up a little bit implicitly in the F-theory context. By the way, there's also a sort of D7 brain interpretation, right? So here you just have n D7 brains, and this is exactly the monodromy that you expect from n D7 brains. here you have ND7 brains plus an orientifold plane. And then the brain interpretation of these cases and these cases is more subtle. And really, I think one argues that there is a brain interpretation because of the geometry rather than vice versa. So sometimes these are called H brains and these are E brains. So armed with this, one can try to go down a little bit in dimension. I guess since I'm here, I want to mention one other thing. So in eight dimensions, I just explained a mechanism for getting A, D, or E gauge groups from the F-theory perspective. And they become M-theory or type 2A if you go down a little bit in dimension without doing anything. In seven dimensions, I get a new thing I can do, which is I can take one parameter family of theories with an ADE gauge group, but I can impose monodromy on the gauge group. Around an additional compactifying circle. And this leads to a gauge group, potentially can lead to a gauge group with non-simply laced algebra. So, for example, I can take a picture in which the Dinkin diagram is a DN Dinkin diagram, and I can exchange these two ends as I go around, and I end up with a natural picture of a Dinkin diagram. I forget which way the arrow goes, but one of these. It's the B case, whichever way the arrow is supposed to go for the B case. I end up with the other orthogonal group as the gauge group. So, again, this picture of getting non-simply laced gauge groups by appropriate twisting in seven dimensions can be done explicitly on the heterotic side, and then you can match that the same mechanism of reduction from eight down to seven, giving you the non-simply laced groups, has to work in this case as well. So, again, if I want to do it in M theory, I should go down to six dimensions. If I want to do it in type 2A, I should go down to five dimensions. Where I would see the now a one an S1 parameterized family of CP1s corresponding to the gauge group, but in a case like that, right, the kind of dual picture of the Dinkin diagram in terms of actual CP1s looks like this. As you went around the loop, these two curves would be swapped. And what that would mean is that there would be just a single family, a connected family of curves going around the loop, which included both of these, whereas these would be individual curves in the family. That difference between one and two times around before you get back to the start is what causes a difference in, when you work out the algebra, a difference in the lengths of the two roots, which is why you end up with one of these non-simply laced diagrams in that particular case. So you see only simply laced Dinkin diagrams in the eight-dimensional F-theory compactification. You can get to non-simply laced algebras in seven dimensions. And then once you get to F-theory in six dimensions, more interesting things can happen. Boy, this is going slow. So I want to talk about what happens with in six dimensions with F-theory or in five dimensions with M-theory or four dimensions with the 2A. So rather than a K3, I'm now going to allow myself to take something two dimensions lower than a K3, and I'm not simply going to restrict to the easiest case, which would be K3 cross T2, but I'm going to replace that with a more general Calabi-Yau threefold. So what can happen on a Calabi-Yau threefold? One of the main kinds of singularities which we discussed on a Calabi-Yau threefold was a case where some divisor on the Calabi-Yau shrunk on the singular model to some curve of singularities. It's not B, it's not C, maybe it's gamma. Shrinks to some curve of singularities. So the typical behavior locally looks like a one complex parameter family of singularities, and you can calculate the spectrum of, in the 2A case, a D2 brain, or in the M theory case, an M2 brain, on this one complex parameter family. Of CP1s, and that spectrum turns out to be, well, for simplicity for a moment, I'm going to assume that this family of CP1s doesn't acquire any singular fibers along the way. So with the assumption that there are no singular fibers, that spectrum turns out to be, so this is equal if no monodromy, like that case, and no singular fibers, the spectrum is equal to G minus 1 adjoint hypermultiplets plus the gauge multiplet. Where G is the genus of gamma. So I get, let's see, so I should mention that the amount of supersymmetry in the effective theory has changed. So in the cases I was talking about until now, I was working in the case where there are 16 supercharges in the theory, but I've just reduced, by replacing K3 cross T2 with a Calabi-Yau threefold, I've reduced to the case of 8 supercharges. I'm phrasing it in terms of the number of supercharges rather than a script n, because the script n values vary a little bit with dimension. So number of supercharges doesn't, and it's more clear to discuss it in these terms. So I have 8 supercharges, and when you look at the gauge multiplet from 16 supercharges and write it in terms of multiplets in 8 supercharges, you discover that there's an additional adjoint hypermultiplet as well as a gauge multiplet. It breaks up that way. And so genus 1, which would be exactly what I would get in the K3 cross T2 case, in genus 1 I get that one additional adjoint hypermultiplet in addition to the gauge multiplet. If the genus is 0, I don't get any adjoints. I just get the gauge symmetry enhancement. And if the genus of the parameter curve is bigger than 1, I get more adjoint hypermultiplets than I would otherwise have expected. So, again, those are massive states when the size of those CP1s is non-zero, but as we approach appropriate places in the boundary of the Kähler cone of the Calabi-Yau threefold, as I explained in the previous lectures, that's one of the main things that can happen, is that a divisor collapses to a curve, and what we see is some non-abelian gauge symmetry enhancement. If there's monodromy, it behaves exactly like in this case that I was mentioning, where it can go to the non-simply laced group instead of the simply laced group. So monodromy on the set of components, this time the monodromy wouldn't just be around a circle, but it'd be monodromy around the parameter curve somehow, right? If the parameter curve is not rational, then its fundamental group has the possibility, I mean, it's non-trivial, so there's the possibility of some monodromy there, and that could correspond to a non-simply laced gauge group in those cases. But what's also interesting is that there can be singular fibers in that kind of fibration. So I drew this as if I had my parameter curve gamma and all CP1s coming along, but it's possible for there to be singular fibers at certain values of gamma. So the CP1 can degenerate, CP1 sub gamma can degenerate at special values, gamma sub 1, gamma sub 0 maybe. Well, let's think a little bit about what this means. So it turns out that when it degenerates, the components of the special fiber are necessarily rigid. So that means there's no complex deformations of this rational curve. Sorry, there's a special case, unless two such divisors are colliding. I forgot about that. Yeah, I'll discuss that case in a minute. But what I've lost is the ability for this guy to move back and forth. Typically, one of these rational curves out here has a normal bundle of the rational curve sitting in the Calabi-Yau being roughly O plus O minus 2, with the O direction in the normal bundle corresponding to the deformation of the curve within the Calabi-Yau, whereas these degenerate fibers typically have normal bundle O minus 1 plus O minus 1, which corresponds to their rigidity. Well, how did Witten and Plesser and me and various people calculate these the spectrum of the wrap brains? The spectrum of the wrap brains were calculated using information about the normal bundle of that curve in the threefold, and so these two cases give different answers. The case where you had a factor of O had enough zero modes in the spectrum to fill out an entire gauge multiplet, but the case where it's rigid doesn't have as many zero modes in the spectrum, and it turns out that the D2 or M2 brains in this case wrapping these components just give a half hypermultiplet typically. Whether it's half or not depends a little bit on the details of the representation theory, but sometimes a half hypermultiplet in the spectrum. So again, that's massive, and again, the limit where we're letting the entire divisor shrink to zero size, these curves must also be going to zero size, so those are going to become additional massless multiplets in addition to the ones that we're seeing from the curve itself. So how do we tell a little bit more about that, about those hypermultiplets? The gauge charges of these hypers are given by intersection numbers of the divisors in question with the curves. And so since those curves live on these divisors, those are non-zero. That's for C contained in D. And so that means that those hypermultiplets have to be charged under the non-abelian gauge symmetry that's being formed by the collapse of the divisor itself. So we end up not with neutral matter, but with charged matter in the spectrum. And it's determined completely by the geometry and by the behavior of the singularities. What does this look like when you've done the collapse? On the Calabi-Yau threefold, you end up with some curve of singularities, which I was calling gamma, but then there are special points along the curve of singularities where something unusual is happening. T- typically the singularity that I might have described here was a quadratic singularity, so it might have looked like x, y equals z squared plus t squared. But then at some parameter value, if this parameter near here is w, then at some parameter value, it might have got an enhancement to t cubed. So at w equals 0, I get z squared plus t cubed. At w not 0, I get z squared plus essentially t squared. So that sort of thing describes what's going on with the singularities. They're kind of equisingular. They look for most values of w like precisely an A1 singularity in the example I've written down, but then at special values, that equisingularity changes, reflected by the degeneration that you see upstairs, and that's reflected in the charge matter spectrum of the effective theory. Okay, so the new thing that happened here was that I could get non-simply laced groups, and the thing which happened here is that I could get additional charged matter, massless charged matter, in the spectrum, possibly some adjoints, as well as whatever representations of the group are dictated by this kind of singularity. So there are several papers which analyze in some detail the kinds of degenerations of fibers that might be occurring and make links between those degenerations of fibers and the representation theory of the corresponding group. I don't think it can be said that that task has been completed in any sense, but at least enough tools have been formulated so that in any specific example, I believe you could work out what the precise representation theory was. Okay, so this was the first half hour. So I just wanted, yes?
In these cases, the hypermagic text, can it be interpreted as, I don't know, like in terms of a differential operator in this family, like the debar operator along the fiber or something?
I don't know of an interpretation like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so so I was going to do, I was going to talk about 2B, and I was going to talk about brains in 2B, and the 2B story was going to be short, but the brains in 2B was going to be at least as thorough as what I've just done for 2A, and so obviously I'm not going to get to that very much today, but let me just introduce it. So there's another sort of application of the ideas from singularity theory. And it may look similar, but in fact the flavor of how the singularities show up in the physics when it's done this way is really quite different. It has a lot of points of contact, but it's really quite different from this story of the 2A. And that comes by looking at 2B models with space filling, so 2B models where the complex dimension of y is 6, is the complex dimension is 3, and we have space-time filling D3 brains. So models like this have a lot to recommend them. They're closely related to a class of F-theory models. They're models which have been studied quite a bit in phenomenological terms, and they're related to the ADS-CFT correspondence. If we simply take the space-time filling D3 brains to lie at ordinary points of the Calabi-Yau manifold, then the picture is exactly a nonlinear version of ADS-CFT. And we can take the approach to the brain as asymptotically looking like an ADS space. Well, it asymptotically looks like the sphere bundle inside the normal bundle. So these are located at points in the Calabi-Yau manifold. The normal bundle to the point is some R6, some local six-dimensional neighborhood. If you take a little sphere around it, you have the S5, which is the sort of boundary of a ball near the point. And then in the ADS-CFT correspondence, you end up with S5 cross ADS5, describing the entire space. And there's a lot of interesting physics having to do with relating. Well, anyway, there's a lot of interesting physics in this situation. And putting those brains inside of a Calabi-Yau compactification kind of blends together this local situation, which is understood quite well, with actual compactifications. In particular, you can put more than one brain at a single point and end up getting some... I should have mentioned, for those who don't know, that there is, of course, an SUN gauge group sitting on, or a UN gauge group rather, sitting on top of a D3 brain. So you get some gauge symmetry in the effective theory, which is coming from the brains and supplements any gauge theory which might have arisen just from the Calabi-Yau compactification itself. So the other application that I mentioned has to do with, so here P in Y was a smooth point, but you can try to play the same game where P in Y is a singular point. And there's sort of two ways of thinking about this problem. In one way of thinking about the problem, you resolve the singular point in whatever way it resolves. And you imagine putting D5 or D7 brains, which somehow wrapping various cycles on the resolution. And you use that to make a model of the physics of the brain at a point. So this leads to various kinds of quiver representations of the physical theory. And the details of exactly which ones you get and how and why, it depends on the singularity, it depends on the geometry of the resolution. And since I will give part four of these talks about this someday in the near future, I won't say too much. Try to say too much about it today. But the sort of alternate point of view that you can take is to modify the ADS-CFT correspondence, in which you take the boundary of a small neighborhood. So I take some five manifold, which is the boundary of a small neighborhood. And I hope that the limit is uniform enough that I can use M5 cross ADS5 to model the physics. Now, this is a really nice idea, and this works well in a few cases. It works, I have to say, awkwardly in a few more. And is not known in general. In fact, in general, it's probably too simple-minded. In general, it's probably not true that simply using the boundary of a neighborhood and a radial direction coming in is enough, it gets enough of the asymptotic information. So it's probably true that we need some kind of refined version of this story in which we consider more asymptotic information than is simply available from this Phi manifold. And that probably explains why it's not known quite in this form in general. But certainly, one expects to be able to, on the one hand, describe the physics in terms of this idea of wrapping cycles around, wrapping brains around cycles on the resolution, and to somehow match this with the asymptotic behavior, which is somehow related to the ADS-C of T correspondence on this side. So anyway, in the next part of these talks, I will try to explain something about what's known about that correspondence as another application. And before I do that, I want to talk about the gauge symmetry enhancement story in 2B outside of, sort of independent of the question of brains, which is a more delicate question, not as well understood as the 2A story that I sketched today. All right.
When you talk about the Cleaver theory, I want to mention Graham category and exceptional
process. I can possibly do that. There are several people in the room who would like to hear about it, probably. In fact, one of the ideas that we had was that we should have a few lectures toward the end of the quarter, which are to warm people up for the tutorial lectures at the beginning of the geometric languages program at KTP in July. And so I don't exactly know what sort of warm-up people are going to need, but that question is going to be related to it in some way.
I have a question about this case when you have a family over S1 of rational, not rational, elliptic surfaces. Can that be understood somehow as Bordism between these surfaces or something? Is it somehow restricted what kind of steps I go through in?
Well, I'm supposing it's a smooth family, so I've got to have some kind of discrete symmetry to do the gluing at the two ends, right?
Okay.
I don't know how to relate it to Bordism.
You mentioned a little bit about the spectrum of hypermatrix and gauge. Can they be also computed by the Gopakuma-Vafa invariant?
Well, so to do Gopakuma-Vafa, I need to be in this case where I'm wrapping some brains around. So I could try to. Oh, I see what your question is. Because I am wrapping brains, of course, to get that massive state. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if anybody's tried that. Somebody might have. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of a linearization of the problem is the way Witten first set it up, where you've got just this brain that's supposed to wrap this particular submanifold and use the normal bundle information, and you've sort of linearized the operators and calculated a spectrum, and since you got the right answer, you stop. Typically, right?
What's the question again?
The question was whether somehow that spectral computation, which told you that you got a hypermultiplet from wrapping certain kinds of curves and a gauge multiplet from wrapping others, if that could be done somehow using Gopakuma-Vafa invariants.
So the Gopakuma-Vafa invariant is supposed to be the order characteristic of the modular space of curves embedded in the Calabi-Yau microcurve.
Yeah.
Mathematically, it seems to be different information.
Well, the moduli space of the rigid curve is a point, and its other characteristic is 1. And the moduli space of these moving curves, I'm not sure if Gopakuma-Vafa is supposed to apply to the case of a moving curve. Maybe it is. That was some curve of genus G, and so 2 minus 2G was.
I'm talking about the moduli space of moving curves. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so the other characteristic is 2 minus 2g. So that sounds related to the g minus 1 answer that I got. But I don't know how to separate. I don't know how to separate that one from the rigid case where the moduli space was a point, and I got a single hypermultiplet. It may be related. It may be related. You have more questions? You look like a person.
I'm not sure how to talk about the distillation, but maybe I just got to be in a future talk. But okay, you talked about the D5 or D7 brain grabbing brain is in an application for edit 50.
Right.
But I know that people also often talk about exception operation Dirac category.
Right.
So the Dirac category, is it supposed to be more precise language for dealing with these brains?
The derived category is supposed to be precise language for dealing with the topologically twisted version of this story. And I didn't really mention topological twist today. So, you know, I was probably talking about physical brains, and if you're talking about physical brains, then the best approach that we have at the moment about physical brains is to regard the derived category as defining some large space of possible brain states, and then the physics defining something about where in that space we live. So the derived category, I think, is a necessary tool to understanding the possible states. But then if you actually want to do physical states, you need this additional information to figure out which of those topological states are physical. Derived categories for the topological twist. Not just the large volume limit, but for any value of the parameters, but with a topological twist. Yes?
Can you remind me, when you have a curved brain, you have, since you have a non-trivial normal bundle,
right,
to get the supersymmetry to work out, you need to have some sort of twisting of the supersymmetry generators. How is that related to the topological twist?
So you can, when you have the normal bundle, and if you want to describe a topological version of the brain theory, then you have to look at what things in the normal bundle also need to be twisted. So you can kind of twist some things in the normal bundle corresponding to the fields that were supposed to be twisted in your topological field theory. And exactly how that goes, I would need to look back up, because I don't have it at my fingertips. But
okay, so there's twisting for the normal bundle, and then you can do an additional twisting to make it topological.
Well, the normal bundle, the fact that I've got a non-trivial embedding means that there's some normal bundle which affects the operator describing fluctuations. But having set up that quantum mechanical system, or quantum field theory system, I can now ask about the topological twist of it.
Okay.
And that operator, various parts of it, I mean, when you're twisting various parts of it, it means taking, you know, normal bundle with values and forms instead of just the fiber.
I thought the story was that when you embed D brains in a Carabian manifold, when you wrap D brains around the submanifold in a Carabian manifold, it's automatically twisted.
Well, there are two meanings of the word twist. Yes, the sigma model is twisted by the normal bundle. And that's true whether we're talking about the physical action or the topological sigma model. But then there's this thing called the topological
twist. What I mean was the topological twist of the gauge theory, depending on the world volume of the universe. I thought it's automatically twisted. I mean, in order to preserve supersymmetry, in order to have supersymmetry for the world volume theory,
That statement sounds familiar, but I don't remember exactly. Right. Yeah, I think that might be right. Yeah.